Like I said at the beginning of the semester, one of the reasons why this course exists is because amphibians are declining globally. And we've just really actually recognized that in the past, 15 to 20 years. And there are several hypotheses that have been generated in trying to explain why declines are occurring. And it's likely multiple factors. In fact, we know that it's multiple factors in many cases, and perhaps several of these factors actually interacting together in a synergistic context to result in local populations going extinct or having local die-offs. And then there are some things that certainly have widespread possibilities of impacting amphibians. So what we're going to do is I'm going to first take you through a little bit of the history, our current knowledge of the status of amphibians, current population levels, etc. And then we'll brainstorm about some of the hypotheses. And before we get to that, I'll ask you really not to look through your notes, and we'll see if we can come up with most of the hypotheses before we really talk about those. Okay, this says amphibian population declines in malformations, and that malformation should actually be deleted because I am not going to talk about those. Nathan's talking about that as part of his 533 presentation. So in the past, I would talk about both of these things together, and I just actually deleted those slides off. And okay, so let's talk about population declines. The history of population declines is basically in the late 1980s, in the 1980s and getting into the early 1990s, ecologists around the world were noticing die-offs of amphibians. And that started to create concern, create discussion, etc. Die-offs were being reported, but there really wasn't any quantitative evidence of global amphibian declines. There certainly was concern that this was occurring. Paper was published in 2000 in Nature that provided the first quantitative evidence that indeed on a global scale amphibians were declining. And then later on this was supported by a subsequent publication in Science and in 2004 by a group of different authors. North America has experienced a linear decrease in number of amphibians going back from 1960 through the 1990s. These were the data that were included in Houlihan. And Western Europe also experienced declines. Certainly it appears more of a rapid decline in the 60s and in the 70s, and it appears that things have stabilized, although that really just could be an artifact of the data that they used. Australia has experienced significant declines. There have been declines through Central America. So basically on most of the continents that we've seen that amphibians exist, we've seen declines. And in areas where we haven't, it's probably just because we haven't been collecting the data. Okay. There are some very unique species that are presumed to be extinct. And we'll talk a little bit about those. Bottom left is the golden toad. Was originally declared to be extinct, but they're wondering if it... toad usually doesn't come out very often, and they're wondering if it is truly extinct now. The mouth brooding frogs were pretty confident those are extinct, and we'll talk a little bit about those. Dr. Hooverman talked about those a little bit when he was going through amphibian families. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the history of declines, at least to our knowledge, and I'll preface all this just by saying that we are collecting more data now than ever before. So we're documenting more declines. So that biases our realization of the rate of declines and the extent of declines. They certainly could have been occurring for much longer periods of time. But basically, from the evidence we have, is prior to the 1970s, there really weren't a whole lot of declines that were being documented. And then we see an accelerated rate of declines. Basically, well, in the 1980s and into the 1990s and into this century now. All of this, the documentation of declines in the 80s and the 90s created concern, and it was brought to discussion during 1991, the first Congress of, I've got it on a future slide here, meeting of amphibian experts from around the world. I think I've got a couple slides. We'll talk about that when I get to it. Okay. You probably saw that. I was going to propose this question. Maybe you didn't. How many amphibians have gone in the United States or in North America? Any idea? If you did see it, then don't comment. Don't comment. How many do you think have gone extinct? I will say since 1980 that the number of species that we have documented worldwide going extinct is around 180. How many do you think have occurred in our country?
I'd say
less than 10.
Less than 10?
In the tropics. That's correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Less than 10. Any other thought? 25? Just throw it out there. It might as well. What the heck? A lot of folks have heard about amphibians declining, even outside of the biology field. And it has received a lot of press, and that's a good thing. Interestingly, though, there's only been one species that's gone extinct in the United States, and that is the Vagus Valley leopard frog. Last time it was documented was 1942, and no individuals have been found since then. Very, very small distribution, very localized distribution in southeastern Nevada. And so you've got a little bit of information there on the Vagus Valley leopard frog, Rana fisheri. Okay, however, in the United States, we have several species that are listed as threatened, federally listed as threatened or endangered. That's what this handout is here for you. Let's see here. We have 17 total, 10 endangered, 7 threatened, 8 are awaiting listing, being considered right now and waiting to be listed. As far as states or regions have the greatest number of federally listed species, California has the most with 6 species. The Southeast together has 5 species. Wyoming has 1 species. Southwest has 6 species. The Chiricahua leopard frog is one species of serious concern. It's experienced over 80%. Decline recently in its populations, and there are some thoughts about why that's occurred, and we'll touch on those. Yeah, you know, so why California? That certainly is a very reasonable explanation. They also have received some of the species that are on there, at least one of the species, is experiencing serious declines because of the chytrid fungus, which we'll talk about. But really only one of those, which is the yellow-legged frog. Okay. Let's see. What else? What about our state, right? Before we jump on to some more stuff. We do not have any federally listed species in our state. however, as Matt Niemiller mentioned, the sea salamander is listed at the state level. Okay? Let's see here. I thought I had copied what these codes mean, but apparently I didn't. I must have hit one to two-sided and it didn't copy or something like that. What I'll do is for for Tuesday, I'll bring in the what all these codes mean. S1 for S1, S2, S3 for the state listing. And S1 is the greatest concern, going to S, I guess it goes down to S5, which is of less concern. And then as far as the global ranking, G1 to G5, where G1 has the greatest concern and G5 the least. Okay. MC for federally listed that you see there is a species of management concern. So you can see that the hellbender, seepage salamander, pygmy salamander, Yonalaska salamander, and the Tennessee salamander at the federal level are considered species of management concern. And the gopher frog, PS, is PS. I can't remember what that is. You guys remember? Okay. It's been submitted, and I don't think it's been yet listed. Okay, so that kind of gives you a feel here. These species of concern are the ones, this TWRA's list, okay? All right. Okay, any questions? All right, including Puerto Rico. Three species have gone extinct in Puerto Rico of the 24 species on the island. They're all coquis, the golden, mottled, and web-footed coqui. And I believe the golden coqui, that's new. Javier, do you know if they think it's extinct? When I was in Puerto Rico, I worked down there 10 years ago, it was still thought to be around, but I think they're now declaring it extinct. Let's see, one species of toad, two species of coqui. I can't remember what I had on there for those. I think those are listed. Those are federally listed. In Puerto Rico, they also federally list their species through Fish and Wildlife Service. So one species of toad and two species of coqui are listed federally. In the Caribbean in general, across all the islands, it's estimated that 61% of the species in the Caribbean are in decline. I'll have another picture. I'll talk about that in just a little bit. Okay, Australia is a continent that's also experienced significant declines. 8 species are extinct there, recently extinct that are known. There are 6 species in serious decline. And then, as I mentioned before, gastric brooding frogs are extinct. They were just discovered in the 70s. And again, this is a species where it actually ingests the fertilized egg, and the tadpole develops within the gastrointestinal system of the frog. And the way it can survive is that it internally turns off its own GI system, and it quits producing enzymes, so it doesn't digest its young. They go through metamorphosis, and then they crawl on out here. You can see here, and they're ready to live in the terrestrial environment. Now, I'm not a fanatic of talking about what the heck is going on here with my laser pointer. There we go. See a little frog? I'm not a fanatic of talking about or emphasizing the importance of amphibians for the sake of human progress. But just imagine this frog. If it has the capability of turning off its own gastrointestinal system, just imagine if we were able to capitalize off of that with respect to all the gastrointestinal illnesses that we have in the world. There certainly would be things to learn. Many of the peptides, antimicrobial peptides in the skin of amphibians have been isolated and actually been shown to kill HIV. So there are things that we can, as humans, use amphibians to benefit our, I guess, our own populations. This is, I think, that just what a unique life history strategy. That's probably the greatest loss, in my opinion, of losing species like this. There is no doubt, and when you hear Roberto Brenes come and talk, you'll really kind of feel depressed. Because Roberto has been studying the chytrid fungus in Panama for the past 3 or 4 years. And that fungus has gone through, and basically what he did is he got in front of the fungus, he documented amphibian populations, and then the fungus passed through and pretty much killed everything. And there are species, when he was just down there doing his work, he documented like 3 or 4 new species. Never been recorded ever before. And these are big species. They're like this big. You know, it isn't like some little glass frog that's this big. And he described them. And at least a couple of those species, they're probably extinct. And so there's no telling how many species really we have lost. There are a hell of a lot more, I guarantee it. Than we realize or we've documented.
Yeah. I know you've got a couple of his species that are only alive kept in the lab.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I think a couple of the. Well. Do you know which ones?
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's some glass frogs that had been described that he even brought back and they're keeping alive. There's a whole initiative actually called the Noah's Ark Project, which he'll talk about, which is this attempt to basically get in front of chytrid. It's moving south through Central America and collect species because it's like trying to stop an avalanche and we have no idea how to stop this pathogen. Trying to collect some species and basically have them in captivity until we figure out what to do. And anyways, that's an effort right now. Any other questions, comments? Okay. Costa Rica, well, one species has been declared extinct, the golden toad, and really have no idea how many are extinct. It's really way above one, there's no doubt, okay? Again, things with the chytrid fungus particularly, moving through there, I mean, we probably are talking, you know, several tens, if not over 100 species, you know, could have gone extinct. Because the thing about the tropics, because of the evolutionary history of amphibians, there are some that are very, very, very endemic and specialized and only exist on just one mountain peak. And their distributions are very small for many species, especially where chytrid moves through, which is at high elevations. I don't want to get into that too much because we're going to talk about that in a little bit, but at any rate. Okay, so let's take a look here. Global distribution of amphibians, looking at the diversity of species, you see the highest diversity of species is located along the equator, and the highest diversity is in Central South America, right here, and into Central America. Okay, and this is strongly correlated with the number of anurans species, as you recall from Dr. Hooverman's lecture showing the distribution of amphibians. This is, well, there's basically global distribution of anurans, but most of the highest anuran diversity is around the tropics, okay? All right, let's see here. I want to put this in perspective for the Brits. One-third of, and it's been estimated that one-third of amphibian species are in threat of extinction. 43% of amphibian species are currently in decline. Now, to compare that with mammals and birds, 12% of birds are considered in threat of extinction, 23% of mammals. So certainly this group of vertebrates is experiencing accelerated declines at magnitudes much higher than other vertebrate classes. That's something we need to think about, and why might that be happening? Why is this happening to amphibians? Okay. This is a distribution of threatened amphibian species on a global perspective. And just hit this off for a second. You can see we're talking about number of species in red being the highest number, up to 30 species or so. And you can see, where does the red occur? There's shades of red basically in Central America, parts of South America. Again, this is where most of our species occur, and also the Caribbean is an issue. And so I'm going to zoom in on this area, especially since it's of regional concern to us. I already mentioned since 1980 we know of 120 species that have gone extinct. So let's zoom in on it. And you can see the highest number of species hot spots are basically in Costa Rica and then coming down into Panama here. Okay, chytrid is actually moving southward in this direction. I'll make a point here. This is this region right here, largest number of species, but the Caribbean, the greater and the lesser Antilles islands, coming from Cuba and going all the way down into the lesser Antilles, have experienced the highest proportion. There are fewer species that are on these islands. But if you look at how many of the total number of species in that region have gone extinct, the Caribbean region has experienced over 80% loss in the number of species. So this region is a concern, and there are a lot of factors that are playing in here, high population densities, habitat destruction, as well as pathogens. Okay. These declines that we're seeing in Central America are often in very pristine areas where there are no humans. So that there's a lot of folks that have come up with different hypotheses of why that might occur when you really don't have humans around. One is the chytrid fungus, which isn't such of a hypothesis because it's been definitely observed. Okay. Let's see what else. This just summarizes, this is a pie chart here, kind of summarizing our current understanding of basically amphibian losses. And this is a really good, this is a global effort, y'all, of documenting basically numbers of amphibians out there, are they in decline, etc. And we'll talk about monitoring efforts even here in our own country in a second. Basically, we're going from, these are, for these acronyms, I'll go through what they mean. This is extinct. We have around, 5,000-6,000 amphibians species. This is extinct, critically endangered, vulnerable to extinction, near threatened. So basically all of these pieces of the pie chart, which if you add those up, go up to around 43%, are considered in threat of extinction. Okay? Well, maybe they add up to about a third of the pie chart. This is least concern. These are populations that have been documented not being in decline or very abundant. And then over here, data deficient. About a quarter of the species out there we really have no information on. I'll break this down into a table for y'all so you can get a little bit better appreciation of these data and where this data deficiency really is occurring. Okay, this is a good website to go to if you want to learn more about the status of amphibians. Any questions with that pie chart or anything? Okay. Here's a table. Again, we have our classes up here going from extinct, believed to be extinct, critical, et cetera, to really these are not a concern or low concern, no data. Okay. Let's see. So for the classes CR, EN, and VU, we have, if we add those up across the orders, there are around 1,600 species of anurans that are in threat of extinction, around 250 species of salamanders, that are, and at least to our knowledge, around 5 species of the caecilians. If we look, though, with respect to percent decline, we do have, the, as you recall from Dr. Hooverman's lecture, the most species that we have are in the anurans, okay, and followed by the caudates, then the caecilians. Yeah, there we go, total around 6,000 species. If we look at percent, we're talking, actually, the caudates appear to be having greatest number of species with respect to their particular order, greatest percent loss, the greatest number of those that are in threat of extinction. So around 50%, around 30% for the anurans, and less for the caecilians. However, let's look across here, y'all. Look at how many are data deficient. Again, there's very little known on caecilians. And their life history, their ecology, the impacts of pathogens, humans, etc. Again, these animals are mostly subterranean, and very little research has been done, so who really knows what's going on with this entire order? overall, again, we're back here to that 23%. Again, about a quarter of the species we really don't even have enough information on. Any questions with that? So, from a total number perspective, there are more frogs and toads that are in threat of extinction than any other order. However, percentage-wise, the caudates are more than the other two orders. And really, in reality, we don't know a whole lot about caecilians. Okay? All right. Any questions with that? Okay, let's talk about some global efforts. The Declining Amphibian Task Force was established in 1991 after 1989 First World Congress of Herpetology. And it is combined, it's a group of 3,000 or more scientists from 90 different countries. And the whole goal of the Declining Amphibian Task Force is basically to create partnerships within countries, among countries, to ultimately document the distribution of amphibians, their current abundance, as well as guide research efforts. And they actually have a publication that comes out, I can't remember if it's monthly or quarterly, but it's called Frog Log, and you can have that emailed to you if you get on their website. It's kind of interesting. Again, blah, blah, blah. So, again, looking at the current distribution, but also the whole point of conservation in general is to try to reduce the impacts of whatever is causing a species decline. That is the field of conservation biology. And so that's ultimately, we're not even there. We're still trying to figure things out right now. So, why are things declining? And what can we do then ultimately to reverse those? In North America, we have the North American Amphibian Monitoring Program, and the whole goal of it is to document the current status of distribution of amphibians. In the state of Tennessee, we had a Tennessee Amphibian Monitoring Program, TAMP. Okay? And again, there's a TAMP workshop coming up this Friday. Is that tomorrow? I don't know what day it is anymore. So at noon, if you guys are interested, our TAMP state coordinator will be here. Okay? You need to know about TAMP and the protocol, et cetera, and those are two required readings if you're unable to come tomorrow. They're on the website. So, again, it actually, when this is set up, there's a five-pronged approach to monitoring amphibians, documenting their distributions. One is call surveys, one is producing atlases, one is aquatic surveys, one is terrestrial salamanders, and then there are a group of surveys for just the Western North America. As it's turned out, this was when it was originally developed in 1995. It's developed through USGS. But really the only thing that has really taken off in some organized fashion is the call surveys. And most states have monitoring programs, but not all. And most of them follow the protocol set up by the North American Amphibian Monitoring Program, but not all of them, okay? Tennessee, our program, we follow what was established by the North American Amphibian Monitoring Program. That is collected here throughout our state. It goes to our state coordinator, who then sends it to USGS. And again, from that point, then it goes to the Global Amphibian Assessment Program, part of Decline Amphibian Population Task Force, and that information goes all together again to get a feeling for distribution of amphibians. So, this is a good way to volunteer and to kind of be a part of this global initiative. And if you're interested in volunteering to get extra credit, we have five routes that we run through the Department of Forestry, Wildlife, and Fisheries, and specifically the Student Chapter of the Wildlife Society. And there will be opportunities to go on those and help out if you want. There are, before the end of the semester, there are two runs before the end of the semester. One that needs to be completed before February 20th, and the other one, it'll be basically in March or in April. And there are coordinators that we have for those routes. And I can put you in contact with those individuals if you're interested in going along. Okay. Questions? All right, so lots of folks. Before I get to that, why might amphibians be declining? We haven't really gotten into the biology of amphibians. That's starting with the next group of lectures. Starting actually next Thursday with Dr. Echternach, and then a series of lectures that I'll be giving and Dr. Hooverman. Well, in order to kind of think about why this might be happening, I'll kind of introduce you first to some just basic biology of amphibians, which is pretty intuitive if you've been around or you've handled an amphibian. First of all, this is just a definition of amphibians. Exothermic vertebrates with a biphasic life cycle and part. Okay, biphasic means simply that you have an aquatic stage and you have a terrestrial stage. Not all amphibians are like that, but in the temperate regions, most of them are. Okay, we have a larval stage, you have a post-metamorphic stage, and what that does, that life history cycle strategy, is that you are exposed to all these things going on in the aquatic environment and in the terrestrial environment, and you're dependent on both. So that makes this group of vertebrates very unique. Okay? Things have to be okay in environments. Secondly, amphibians have very thin, permeable skin that has to remain moist. Okay? And the level of moisture is and capabilities of dealing with loss of moisture differs drastically among amphibian species, going from some that really don't lose water very much, they have very thick skin, or they have different adaptations for dealing with dry conditions. which we'll talk about later with the estivation lecture. But all amphibians need to keep their skin moist. One primary reason is to help with cutaneous respiration. Okay, so most amphibians respire cutaneously. In fact, a lot of amphibians, that's the only way they can respire. And the other reason is for osmoregulation. They actually, there's a lot of transfer of ions across amphibian skin that is critical to their survival. And so they have to keep that moist in order for that to occur. Consequently, things that are bad that may be in water can also be absorbed through amphibian skin. Okay? So they need water. They're in water a lot. They behaviorally hydroregulate, which means they actually go to water. They'll uptake water into their body through their skin. Some species do have a capability of estivating, which is a whole strategy that we'll talk about later. So desiccation is a lifelong struggle. They absorb compounds readily. So again, water, they need water. They can absorb chemicals. The water needs to be relatively decent in water quality. And the other thing is they have relatively low agility, relatively low capability of getting up and moving. Okay, and moving from one area to another if it gets poor at one site. And let me see, I do have another one. And they're long-lived. So average lifespan of amphibians is, 7 to 10 years about. And so they're around. So here's something, again, aquatic and terrestrial environment. Water, you have to have water around. It has to be decent quality water. You're using that terrestrial environment as well, and often quite a distance sometimes away from the water source. You can't move very far because you really have to hop along. It's not a very efficient way to move. And you're long-lived. You have to stick around. So this is a reason why amphibians are often called very important indicator species of environmental degradation. Okay? So they're often considered, the canaries of vertebrates, because of these life history characteristics. And it probably is the reason, one of the reasons driving why amphibians are decreasing at a rate more than birds or mammals. Okay. Any questions? Make sense? Okay. With respect to their ability to move, are things that we can do to the landscape that basically movement of animals just in general among populations that are spatially separated is a very important and natural population process. But when we get out there and we begin to affect the terrestrial landscape through putting roads, forestry practices, agricultural practices, mining, etc., we create barriers to animals, and especially little guys that are hopping along. So, you might be able to walk across a road pretty easily, or you might even be able to walk from, come out of a forest and walk across a cornfield or a cotton field pretty easily. But you have to think about what the amphibian is actually perceiving. There's lots of studies, which we'll talk about later, about how these different land uses can deflect movement and can actually function as barriers. And that can affect the ability of populations to interact. In the temperate landscapes in our country, amphibians are often strongly correlated with basically wetland sites that have permanent water or temporary water, and they periodically interact with other populations through dispersal. And this is a very simplified example here in this landscape, which is in the Great Plains, the Southern Great Plains. So you have these different populations, or what are called subpopulations, interacting, and you know, they aren't able to get up and fly, or you know, run like a deer. You know, this is basically this. I like a little picture of an amphibian here instead of a frog, or instead of a turtle. But the point is that they really can't move very much, and things that interrupt basically that connectivity, the natural connectivity of a landscape, can affect their movements. So there's lots of issues with affecting those movements, and there are two primarily on the bottom. You can have demographic issues because no longer can individuals naturally, and typically what you see with movements is it's the metamorphs. It's the ones that go through metamorphosis, the juveniles that are getting out of that population, getting out of the water and actually dispersing during nights or rain events across. And if you prevent that, you create an unnatural structure, and a lot of those individuals may not be able to survive across the landscape, and that really can affect populations. The other thing is that interaction, that physical interaction and transfer of individuals among populations helps increase genetic diversity, which, as you all know from general ecology, is something that we try to preserve in populations, because the greater the diversity of your genome, the greater the likelihood is that you can respond to environmental changes and disturbances, etc. So maintaining high genetically diverse populations is a good thing, and in particular we should be promoting that instead of not promoting it through changes in land use. And so that's a big direction, or a big focus in conservation biology and landscape ecology. And that's all I'll talk about now, because we'll probably talk about landscape processes in one of the kind of the breakout discussion sessions that we do with papers. So, any questions? There we go. This is a good time, because I'm sure we're there, to take a break, and then we'll hypothesize ourselves how amphibians might be declining, or why they may be declining. Okay, so let's just take 5 minutes. All right, we're back online. Okay, so we're talking about hypotheses. We're coming up with our own hypotheses, see if we can come up with a comprehensive list. There are really 8 total that have been suggested. All right, so let's go ahead and, you said disease, right? So let's do that as one, pathogens. There's lots of different pathogens, so we'll just lump them all into the category. Habitat loss? Yeah. Habitat loss. Next?
Climate change.
Somebody's got to throw it. All right. Yeah. What's that? Predators? Yeah. In particular, introduced predators. And competitors, yeah. So basically, introduce species. Okay. Oh, we got half of them. Okay. Let's think again globally. We've got climate change. What else can happen on a broad scale? Imagine you're sitting around just thinking of stuff. That's what these folks have done. Well, what about this? Any other?
The increase of human population can be one, even though most of the body is not.
Yeah, let's put that up here, basically, because increase in human populations results in all those things that we're pretty effective at doing. others. Chemicals, good one.
Is he talking about like biomagnification?
Well, that could happen too. And we'll just put those all together, that basically chemical pollution. And that could be maybe direct impacts on amphibians, affecting their food source, and biomagnification or bioaccumulation. Yeah. Basically ozone depletion. Global. Two more. Hey, don't be looking. Oh, you read a, yeah, yeah, which one did you read? Semlich's paper?
Alfred.
Oh, Alfred's paper. Yeah, that's a good one, yeah. That's a good one, too. Yeah. All right. What else? Another. There's one direct impact and one larger kind of global impact that's left. Issue that's been a concern for a while now. It's been documented in Great Smoky Mountain National Park on a large scale because of emissions in the Midwest.
Acid rain.
Yeah. Under what? Here? Well, this would be direct chemical application. Yeah, kind of like your insecticides, pesticides type of thing. Yeah. Yeah, so that's going to change pH. All right, last one is related to humans, something that humans can do to amphibians. Eat them. That's right. Food source. So basically, commercial exploitation. So commercial harvesting. And that is common in our country for basically one species, the American bullfrog. And it's really common in many other countries for a food source and also for the pet trade. Legal or illegal? Okay. All right, so those are eight hypotheses that have been thrown out there. What we'll do is we'll go through each of them. I have them categorized into direct impacts and then indirect impacts. Okay? So direct will be how humans, these are all obviously anthropogenically oriented or a cause of humans. And that's very likely why amphibians are declining currently is because of our direct impact on them. Okay. So, what's the number one cause of amphibian declines? We'll start with that. Habitat destruction, degradation is the number one cause. Okay? There we go. Habitat destruction and degradation. So things we're doing to the landscape. I will make note, top right here, you'll see a little way that I've categorized. This is Matt Gray's assignment of how important these factors are. And other folks may agree or disagree, but I think there's some logic behind this. W stands for widespread. And then there's also L for very localized. And then it goes from 1 to 3, where 1 is most has a severe impact and 3 probably less. So this is my way of weighting and putting weight or water on the hypotheses. How likely is this impacting amphibians? Well, certainly habitat destruction and nobody disagrees with that, can have actually very localized effects, and it can have broad scale effects. So obviously if you're destroying a wetland or habitat, very localized, but that also has widespread effects depending on how large that habitat destruction is, and it can also impact that interaction of populations that we've talked about. Okay? Oh yeah, humans and amphibians don't really interact very well. We screw up the aquatic system, we screw up the terrestrial system in lots of different ways. Well, the worst is you may not actually fill in a wetland, but you can just drain the darn thing. And again, most amphibians need to be close to water in some capacity. There are very few that can live in xeric type environments. And they still need water, okay? All right, so some seemingly obvious things that we can do, silviculture, clear cutting. There's somebody's talking about silvicultural practices. So one thing that folks are trying to quantify right now is, all right, are some logging practices, such as partial cuts, shelter wood cuts, do those have less impact than a clear cut, for example? And what types of recommendations can biologists give to foresters to be more environmentally, have less of an environmental impact with respect to amphibian populations? And there's quite a bit of literature out there that talks about that, and there are some current ongoing studies that one very large initiative that's being funded through the National Science Foundation it's really looking at this in the first attempt in a replicated context where they have different treatments of silvicultural treatments across the eastern United States and at least three, if not four, different regions: Maine, South Carolina, Missouri. I think three different regions. I won't steal the thunder. Dallas, you're talking about silviculture, aren't you? I won't steal your thunder, but there's a lot of interesting stuff going on right now. All right, agricultural practices, cropland, agriculture, grazing can have impacts. Development, roads can impact amphibians in two ways, through direct mortality of individuals, and there's quite a bit of work who's doing roads. All right. Quite a bit of research out there impacting, talking about mortality rates associated with roads, and also the impact of roads on movements, deflecting movement like we were talking about before. Urban development's obvious, you know, if you put a subdivision on things, it can block things, kill things, destroy habitat. And just in general across our landscape in the United States, lower 48, 54% of our wetlands have been lost. And again, these are areas that amphibians and use for breeding. Okay. All right. Not so seemingly obvious, and quite frankly, something that we have very little understanding of are things like sedimentation and altered hydroperiods. Obviously, if you drain an area, that's not a good thing. But what about sedimentation rates and a very slow filling up of bottoms because the watershed itself is not intact because we've removed the vegetation? And so you have these high rates, much higher rates of sedimentation into wetlands than you've had in the past. Again, altered hydroperiods, either us actually changing and manipulating water levels in different reservoir systems, wetland systems. And when we talk about management of wetlands, we talk about thinking about the biology of amphibians and when you're managing that hydroperiod. But what are those possible effects? What are the possible effects of burning basic wetland management techniques or wildlife management techniques, mowing and herbicide, broad-scale herbicide, spray and things like that, we really have very little understanding as of right now. Yeah. Yeah, so what might be the impacts of sedimentation and increasing that load into an area? One is hydropure. The other thing is having suspended solids in the water that cover eggs, it can suffocate eggs. Eggs need to be able to respire. So that certainly could be an impact, but as far as quantifying that, to my knowledge, there hasn't been a whole lot done. But it can kill egg masses. Yeah. Other questions? Okay. Dr. Ray Semlich at University of Missouri has really led some really intelligent studies looking at the impacts of humans on a variety of different scales. And there's a good paper here in the Journal of Wildlife Management that he's written kind of talking about different things. It may or may not be actually. I think I have this at the very end of the semester as an assigned reading. Okay. Any questions? Good. All right, next, chemical pollution hypothesis. I rank it as localized and probably not a factor in most cases. And I'll tell you why. Can chemicals impact amphibians negatively? And Jason right now is saying, yeah, you're crazy. And for the most part, the thing is there's new research coming out. Dr. Rick Relier will be coming on over. He'll be able to share some information with you because he has some very convincing evidence that very common herbicides, pesticides that are applied to landscape at environmentally relevant concentrations kill larvae and post-metamorphic amphibians. And that is recent information, and it's good information, and we'll have Dr. Relier talk about that. For the most part, when you measure chemical pesticide concentrations in water sources, they often are at levels environmental at levels that have little impacts, direct impacts on amphibians. There are two types of pollution that we can talk about. One is point source, which is pollution originating from one point. One is non-point source, so like from multiple locations, like an agricultural field or a parking lot. And so when we talk about point source, we're talking about effluent directly coming from some type of plant, some type of discharge. These things are monitored relatively closely. For plants, they have to do water quality testing all the time, and for the most part, because of EPA regulations, they're probably kept at environmentally safe levels. One thing that has not been investigated at all is thermal pollution from electric plants, nuclear power plants, coal power plants, and in order for the energy to be produced, the conductors, etc., that are producing the energy have to be cooled, and so usually water is brought from a system, and it's ran through the system. It keeps the plant in an operating level, and then that water is discharged at a very high, at a very abnormal warm temperature. That certainly can affect amphibians, we'll talk about this, there are ranges of temperature that amphibians develop best at, especially larval amphibians. And this is really what we're talking about in the aquatic environment for the most part. So there's really the impacts of thermal pollution on amphibian populations. To my knowledge, there isn't a whole lot out there. What's that? If they're sufficient enough, yeah. So are EPA standards adequate to protect amphibians? And again, some of the work that Dr. Relier has done has suggested no, and other folks actually that have done. The question is and we're just beginning to understand, still are, with what is applied to the landscape and what gets down into a wetland, is it at a high enough level to negatively impact eggs from hatching, negatively impact larvae from developing, or negatively impact individuals going through metamorphosis and post-metamorphically? And there are cases that certainly are being made that, yes, that chemicals can be at levels that negatively impact one of those life stages. And this is recent information. Historically, it's thought that pretty much no, because what is required to get, for the most part, to get those levels at concentrations high enough to negatively impact amphibians, it's just not economically reasonable to put on a field for producers, and it's generally not necessary either in order to control plants or to control insects that may negatively impact your crop. So wetlands themselves can be repositories of basically chemicals washing down, and that can be a concern because as it's applied on the landscape, it may be at some environmentally relevant concentration, but as it gets concentrated into these areas, if there's any type of life to that chemical, they can exceed environmentally relevant concentrations pretty quickly. What are some chemical effects? There's certainly, for example, your nitrates, your nitrogenous compounds, ammonia. It can have direct mortality, can reduce. Studies that have shown that ammonia is most toxic, and it doesn't take very much. We'll talk about different levels of these, followed by nitrites and nitrates. And insecticides, again, can also have direct mortality. It can reduce growth of amphibians. It can have also have effects such as altered behavior and make them potentially more susceptible to predators. It can induce malformations. And then, as I think Jeremy mentioned, or maybe you did, Chris, about this potential impact and even higher levels of the food chain, because they could there's a possibility for bioconcentration of chemicals and then bioamplification through accumulation through the food web. Okay, other things such as oils and things like that may be on like parking lots or roads, those types of things can actually affect respiration of the eggs and also cutaneous respiration as well. Any questions? Yes, sir. So EPA goes over the entire nation, okay, and at a minimum, all states have to follow those regulations, including Puerto Rico. Then within the states, there can be more stringent laws that are put in place by their environmental state agency. So in our state, it's the Tennessee Department of Environment and Conservation. In Puerto Rico, it's the Environmental Quality Board. Yeah. There's actually Puerto Rico, well, whether or not it's enforced very much, I don't know. But certainly the federal laws of EPA are applicable in Puerto Rico. And also there is an Environmental Quality Board that basically functions like our TDEC that we have here, that looks at water quality, does wetland permitting. Well, no, this is on animals, organisms,
yeah. Well, not fish do? Not necessarily. Yeah, some do, but not necessarily. So the comment is, I should have actually handed this, is basically, you know, what does EPA do? And so what EPA does is they actually are testing on different taxa, zooplankton, fish, mice, etc. But it's very limited, and they don't use amphibians in any as of right now. Not in the past.
If they
it'd be Xenopus, which is the African clawed frog, which is from Africa, obviously. Quite different. This is one thing I forgot to mention. just to give you a little, to give you an appreciation of the evolution and the diversity and the divergent species, is that humans are more genetically related to mice than Xenopus is related to the American bullfrog. There has been more time that's gone through evolutionary history to separate those and make them more genetically different than us and mice. Isn't that amazing? So and the interesting thing is that Xenopus is the lab rat that we use, and it is nothing like anything we have in North America. And it's very different than even other species in Africa. It's totally aquatic, you know, totally aquatic frog. That's very abnormal. Anyways, any other comments?
So why do they use it?
It's easy to breed, pretty much. Yeah, they're easy.
You only need water.
Yeah.
You only need a terrestrial environment.
Yeah. Yeah, and yeah, easy to yeah, and they breed easily.
They just set up closed systems.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Anything like that? Oh, we have amphibians that are easy to raise, but that was the standard that was established in the early 1900s with basic immunological research, and then they've just continued to kind of use that. I think we're starting to get away from that now. All right. The other thing that we need to think about, and this is a recurring thing going through, is sublethal effects. Certainly, chemicals and other things that we'll talk about could impact amphibians in an indirect way, almost by stressing the amphibian. Okay, and ultimately, when you stress amphibian, just like you may be stressed, your immunocompetence drops periodically, or it could be for an extended duration. And that's the greatest concern is what is called chronic stress. So stress that doesn't go away because something is reducing its immune system that makes you more susceptible to being predated. It can affect your ability to grow. You can become infected by pathogens, greater likelihood of being infected by pathogens, etc. So, all right. And the other thing that was kind of brought up, I guess I had something else to dissolve in there, so the food web, is we need to think, you know, you think about these chemicals. If it's washing down and it's knocking out zooplankton and it's knocking out other invertebrates, these are things, or it's killing algae. We'll talk about what tadpoles eat. They eat all those things. They're really very omnivorous. And depending on what's available, they'll eat algae. They'll scrape on leaves and eat small leaves, things like that, and then they'll be herbivorous, and then they'll also eat small aquatic invertebrates, even larger aquatic invertebrates, depending on the species. Okay. Golly, I had something else come in here. All right. Whatever. Comments. We already talked about that. All right. Introduce predators and competitors hypothesis. Local effects, too. Again, I'm thinking this is on like a global scale we're talking, y'all. This certainly can have pretty big impacts in an amphibian community. Okay.
So for folks that are kind of, this is actually a topic that Javier is interested in, and we can get some feedback on this as well, is we really aren't, outside of this right here, we're not talking about the, I don't have it currently scheduled to talk about the impacts of invasive species on amphibians. And there's a little bit of an oversight on my behalf, but we do have that open discussion session that we're going to have, just a roundtable discussion. This would be a really good topic, I think, because there's lots of stuff that we can talk about as far as introduced animals. And some of those things, one is fish, the introduction of fish. Fish are big-time predators, and they eat everything. They'll eat eggs. It depends on the fish species, but just in general as a group. They'll eat eggs. They'll eat tadpoles. They'll eat the adults. Some of the larger fish. So fish can be very significant predators. Some of the common fish that have been introduced and have resulted that we've documented in having negative impacts on amphibians are rainbow trout, largemouth bass being introduced into systems that they weren't normally there. This is the California red-legged frog. There's quite a bit of research that's been done on them. Their populations are declining, and lots of research on the rainbow trout and how it's negatively impacted those populations. Bullfrogs, our wonderful American bullfrog. Next slide, I've got a picture of the of their distribution. Native to Tennessee, eastern United States, and over in the western United States, and actually we ship bullfrogs everywhere. And they will eat pretty much everything, usually not other adult amphibians, although they'll pretty much put anything in their mouth. Another species is a cane toad. I think I have it down here someplace, so I'll just wait till that. This has been another concern is fire ants, and them actually, there is some in some of the more white literature, softer literature. Some folks have documented fire ants actually attacking juveniles and killing them. And this might be something of concern in southern states. Okay, what about competitors? The cane toad or the marine toad, Buffo marinus. And again, bullfrogs can act as competitors as well. And there's a picture of a cane toad right there, native to South America and introduced pretty much globally. Major problems in Australia, and they are in Florida. This is a little news clip that actually one of my former students, Liz Burton, found. And that is a cane toad. I'm going to pass it around. This thing is 2 pounds, 15 inches long. I mean, it is a massive animal. And imagine that thing hopping around. What's that? Oh, really? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so difference between point source and non-point source, and are we talking about chemical transformations? And all chemicals have the capability of transforming in some capacity, some more than others, including pesticides. And when we're talking about point, non-point, we're really talking about the point of origin. And so non-point is broad landscape type origin. So it can be, again, it's usually like coming off of a parking lot, coming off of an agricultural field. It could be fertilizers, it could be phosphorus, it could be nitrogen that's spread across a landscape. And then it may get concentrated into a pond and it may bind very quickly with the soil or be uptake by plants or whatever. The life of a particular chemical depends on its chemical nature, but point source is being emitted like from a plant, like a power plant or some type of chemical plant, like making pharmaceuticals or something like that. Other questions? All right. Yeah, so other things that are issues are things like bait fish and mosquito fish and things like that that we've introduced all over the place. Crawfish are also known predators of eggs and other types of inverts are predators, dragonfly larvae and things like that. But as far as being introduced, crawfish have been introduced in lots of different places to actually raise as a food source, and so that's why they're included here. They can be a predator, but also a competitor, I guess, as well. I would probably say overall, the impacts of predation, introduced predators, is greater than the competitive interactions that could exist from an introduced species. Wouldn't you say that would be fair to say, Jason? Yeah, so was the cane toad introduced to control something? And to my knowledge, I think it was in Australia. And I'm trying to remember what it was. Like,
they use some type of ant.
Ants? Mm-hmm. Ants. Or, it, and the thing was, and then it, yeah, yeah, it was a... Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cane toad's one, man, that is, they're so prolific and they are big time eaters. They probably are almost function more as a competitor.
They're having huge impacts on the
marsupial population. Why? Because they're eating them or something? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, they have huge. Parotoid glands and they're pretty highly toxic. So predator type populations. What was that paper that we read that was claiming that? What was the darn lizards? What was it on? Yeah. Some type of monitor. Yeah. Lizards. They claimed that basically they were eating a bunch of toads and dying, and a very large, long-lived lizard, and in Australia.
And the best
yeah.
Was
yeah.
A dead frog.
Yeah. Yeah. The paper wasn't that great, but it was submitted for publication. But there wasn't a whole lot of evidence. But I wouldn't be surprised if it was true, but they didn't have a whole lot of data to support it. But so here's the native distribution of bullfrogs, very widespread species, actually going up into Canada as well, and introduced. And again, so major impacts. These guys are being introduced for the most part. You can still do it. There aren't any regulations. You can buy bullfrogs online, have them shipped, so you can listen to bullfrogs when you live in Arizona. In your backyard, you know, if you have a little pond, and they make that nice, wonderful sound, and so a lot of those introductions are from people doing it, and are actually us allowing it to be done. All right, commercial exploitation hypothesis: localize less on a global scale. For the most part, a lot of countries have laws against this, but traditionally concerns in the Orient, Southeast. And again, what we're talking about is humans going out harvesting animals and for food or for the pet trade. And so here are a few statistics, y'all, as far as removal. Around 200 million amphibians are exported annually out of Asia. 70 million are exported from India. And again, consumption for consumption in the pet industry. In the United States, this is our species that we produce and we harvest as well. You can harvest bullfrogs, and their legs are pretty darn good. We produce 23 to 72 metric tons of bullfrog legs per year. And this is the other thing, we import like three times that much. It's a crazy thing. So we actually export bullfrog adults for other countries to produce because they can produce them more efficiently. Rana culture is really big in a lot of countries, especially Southeast Asia. And then they'll ship our American bullfrog legs back to us. So we have a lot of frog legs that come in that are produced in other countries. There's a Rana culture facility down in Georgia. It's actually where we get a lot of our animals to do our research. We're a lot of the research that we do in a controlled context is done with this species instead of using Xenopus. And again, they're pretty easy to raise and stuff. That's why we use them. And they have a widespread distribution. So this is direct removal. Then you have problems with intentional or accidental releases, such as Xenopus that you have down here, the African clawed frog. 9 million frogs are shipped from biological supply companies every year in the United States, mostly in the genus Rana. So, you know, leopard frogs and green frogs and things like that for studies, for classroom, grade school type observations. And once they go through metamorphosis, you know, you don't want to tell the kids that you're going to kill the frogs, and so you release them. So is that big of a deal? Obviously, you know, when things like Xenopus are introduced, which exist in our country, lots of different states have these guys living in systems. You might think that's really a big deal. But even our own species and the potential impacts that it can have on native populations can be big, even if it's native to your region. When you bring animals together, you raise them in captivity, the possibility of interaction is much higher contact rates, and consequently a greater likelihood of pathogens being passed from one individual to the next. And then if you release those individuals into a population, they can bring novel pathogens that are of different strain, different evolutionary history into populations that can have really, can result in a die-off. So there's lots of different things, pathogens being affected, also the regional genetic structure that may be quite different than the animals that may be released. And this is from a release standpoint, but there's also concerns, in my opinion, with reintroductions. And we have to be very conscientious and prudent with respect and thoughtful with respect to trying to reestablish populations because of the potential consequence of introducing pathogens or change in the regional genetic structure of a population. So you'll notice as we're going through here, I do have different articles that are cited. So if you're going to be talking about one of these things, this can be one starting point, and if I have quite a few papers on things, and so does Dr. Hooverman, and show you where to find some other papers also. So, what are we doing on time? 6:55. Okay, good. All right. So, direct hypotheses. Let's talk about indirect. All right. Very first one we'll talk about is climate change, global warming hypothesis. Can have widespread impacts, in my opinion. I don't think there's a whole lot to it. Of course, there are folks, Alan Pounds, who would disagree, and a group of folks that would disagree 100% and tell me I'm an idiot, but that's fine. All right. The hypothesis is basically that global warming is changing, are obviously increasing the atmospheric temperature within the world. and ultimately resulting in impacting amphibians. One thought is that the change and subtle change in temperatures are actually acting as a stressor on amphibians and resulting in the immune system being suppressed and then becoming more susceptible to pathogens. It's one of the explanations of why maybe the chytrid fungus is impacting populations, and it primarily impacts populations at high elevations, okay, in mountainous regions. And so maybe just slight changes in that high altitude climate is ultimately suppression. From a larger perspective, things that we're aware of, and especially intimately here in the southeastern United States, is the increase in catastrophic events, which can have pretty severe impacts on populations of amphibians. They like water, but hurricanes are not a good thing for most terrestrial vertebrates. So certainly severe weather events increase in that frequency. Can negatively impact amphibians. Other things such as that are predicted is that as global warming progresses, some areas get warmer and wetter, other areas get drier and hotter, and other areas get, well, I don't think there are any areas that are getting colder, maybe not so much. But at any rate, so that can actually have impacts from an altitude standpoint and a latitudinal standpoint, and those things, especially those really type species, very specialized, very case selected, such as in the tropics at high elevation, slight changes, and they don't have an ability to move, they'll probably be impacted most. So that's an overview of global warming. You want any comments on that? Some of Pounds' ideas.
Well, actually, I've seen more of the work on the Shore Reserve today. So things like the El Nino events, for sure, can actually be good for amphibians because they can knock out their predators. So if you basically dry landscape for a year, for example, you can knock out many predators. So what happens is these ponds go up next year, predator density is lower. You get all these amphibians flocking in and breeding. So their populations go through the roof because you've knocked out the predators because the habitat dried 1 year. So there's some interesting, I think, papers on that we could incorporate as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we have the evidence.
Yeah, so you know, impacts could be, it's almost hard to even think about all the things the warming could do. It could dry up things and make it too dry for amphibians in a region to actually reproduce, period, okay? If all your habitat dries up, if it's not too severe, well then it could have maybe some, or it's very localized where things dry up, it can survive through that particular drought and then it rains again, it can reduce predators, and it can have a positive impact. The predictions that you can make, you know, and what will transpire over our lifetime,
is really hard to predict. You know, it's crazy. There could be positive effects and negative effects, and certainly we'll observe both. There's no doubt in my mind. Okay, well, we'll wrap up with that and finish the hypotheses on Tuesday. Remember, Tuesday we'll start off, the first hour will be on your amphibian exam. And just in making some comments on that, I would expect about half of the salamanders and half of the anurans. You'll have slides to identify, and then about half of the anurans, you'll also have calls to identify. So,
no specimens.
No. I will mention that there will be at least one question or one playback that will be a chorus, so multiple species calling. So that'll just kind of challenge you a little bit. And oh yeah, exactly. Yeah, not just the number of species, because you can just guess, you know. It's important that you actually know what species those are. But what I'll probably do, and I am a kind of a fan of providing at least some extra credit opportunities, is we'll probably have one of those to actually be tested on, and then we'll have another one where you'll have it as extra credit. So
okay.
But yeah, so that's about it. If you have any questions, don't hesitate to ask us. But it won't be too bad. You'll have a minute to look at the slides, and we don't go back through the slides. Again, you need to be able to spell the things correctly. Spelling counts. And you know, again, there might be a few of those life history things I mentioned that are on the slides that are just little tidbits of stuff that might ask you as well. But we should be able to get through that easily within an hour. And then we'll take a break and finish up this lecture. Okay.